I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback, stories from the NPR archives from 25 years ago, more or less. And this month, things are getting kooky with a recurring small animal theme.
I don't really like the critter stories. I don't like dogs that much. Cats I could barely tolerate. Monkeys are always funny, and I'd go for a monkey story every time.
Yep, that's NPR producer Art Silverman. And even though he says he doesn't like critter stories, one of the first pieces he did for NPR was about a rat Olympics. We'll have Art explain as our first file series continues. And the dude who put the wow in the bow wow wow, Mr. George Clinton, talks about the great divide between black and white radio stations in September 1984.
I specialize in real black music, so it'll probably be the last of the music of the black music to go on the non-black stations.
George Clinton speaks out on the lack of P-funk in the music industry in 1984. We'll also have the story of a highly advanced music delivery system called the compact disc.
When do you think we'll reach the point where people won't even think to buy a phonograph record? They'll be buying a compact disc.
A good question that's much easier to answer now than it was 25 years ago. Stay tuned for the official projection. We'll also chat with comedian George Carlin, Ellen DeGeneres, cartoonist Jeff McNally, and we'll learn how to exercise without ever leaving our Herman Miller Aeron chairs.
One thing you have to learn is to move slowly in the beginning. You want to stretch like a cat.
Stretch like a cat, but watch out for those dogs.
This is Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards.
That's Mr. Bob Edwards and the Happy Morning Edition theme song. Up on the big scoreboard, it's Walter Mondale versus Ronald Reagan, with 2 months to go on the countdown clock. Mondale bought lots of campaign ads in September 84 to try and turn things around. Here's the backstory from NPR's Clem Taylor.
In 1969, Mondale fought the Nixon Pentagon plan to build multiple warhead missiles. What he predicted happened, thousands of new nuclear warheads. Today, Mondale fights another ominous scheme. As Reagan plans to put weapons into space, Mondale will stop it.
On Tuesday afternoon here in Washington, in his most stinging attack thus far on Ronald Reagan, Walter Mondale told an audience of college students just what he thinks about political advertising in general and Ronald Reagan's campaign advertising in particular.
I have been advised to ignore the issues, to choose slogans over substance, and my answer is no. I believe there's a big distance between Pennsylvania Avenue and Madison Avenue.
200 miles, give or take a few. But whether he chooses issues or slogans for his message, Mondale will be doing a lot of television advertising of his own in the coming weeks. The first Mondale commercials went on the air September 10th, and comparing them with the advertising of incumbent Ronald Reagan, Mondale campaign officials are prepared to make a bold admission.
I don't think it probably looks as good because it doesn't have the sort of Pepsi model, but I don't think that people buy Pepsi or Coke so much because of the look, but because of the taste.
Richard Leone is a senior advisor to Walter Mondale in charge of communications.
The Reagan commercials don't say anything. They talk about how nice things are and show a lot of visual images. Mondale's commercials demand more of people. They demand or ask of people that they think.
Mr. Reagan's Undersecretary of Defense once said this about a nuclear attack. Everybody's going to make it if there are enough shovels to go around. Dig a hole, cover it with a couple of doors, and throw 3 feet of dirt on top.
In another commercial entitled Freeze, there are no pictures of missile silos or warheads. Instead, glimpses of Mondale as statesmen, meeting with Sadat, Deng, Marcos, and Begin. We see Mondale on the flight deck of a carrier. Macho military images to sell a nuclear freeze.
All across the world, whether negotiating trade in China, keeping our military bases in the Philippines, paving the way for Camp David, Walter Mondale has been there. An Army veteran, a solid leader, Mondale's defense plan calls for real growth in military spending, combat readiness, and active pursuit of a mutual verifiable freeze on nuclear arms. It's a plan for peace that deals from strength. Mondale, he's fighting for your future.
He might have been fighting for our future, but his future was not looking so good. Mondale's poll numbers were way down in September. Here's pollster Lou Harris with a prognosis.
On a personality appeal basis, Reagan is ahead of Mondale by fully 27 points. On which man is most appealing, it's close to no contest. Reagan seems to inspire, Mondale does not. Most of all, though, Mondale is thought to be just plain dull. To make the election close, Mondale's only hope is not to rev himself up to win a personality contest. Instead, he needs to learn how to communicate sharply on one key dimension, how he differs with Ronald Reagan on the issues. You know, if Mondale tore into Reagan on the issues, maybe then he'd no longer be dull.
Well, I wouldn't put money on that one. But political cartoonist Jeff McNally did take the opportunity to tear into both candidates on the issues. He talks to NPR's Scott Simon.
Are you drawing something now? I hear a pen scratching. What are you drawing?
I was drawing Mondale, as a matter of fact.
Really?
Yeah.
You're drawing Mondale at our bureau there?
What, you can hear a ballpoint pen from there?
We have a very expensive, sophisticated satellite system. Mr. McNally, who won the Pulitzer Prize for political cartooning twice now, at the age of 36, says that the most comedically inspirational events of this campaign season so far have been the candidacies of Reverend Jesse Jackson and Geraldine Ferraro. But because both Reverend Jackson and Geraldine Ferraro come from constituencies which haven't before been represented in a major party national campaign, Mr. McNally says that a political cartoonist like himself, drawing for a conservative newspaper like the Tribune, finds himself a bit restrained.
You really tend to be very careful, which is it kind of goes against the grain for a political cartoonist, but you do find yourself saying, is this thing I'm doing on Geraldine Ferraro a blatantly sexist thing? Am I not being sensitive enough to women's issues? And then with Jesse Jackson, you don't want to, you know, you want it to be making fun of Jesse Jackson, not making fun of blacks who happen to be running for political office. So it's, you know, you drop back and have second thoughts on that because, you know, as a white male, I have no problem messing around with Mondale or Reagan or anybody else. But with those two, you really do kind of have second thoughts.
You did a cartoon for the Chicago Tribune just a couple of days after Mrs. Ferraro's selection was announced, which I showed around our headquarters here in Washington. It was Mr. Mondale standing in some, like, Oshkosh B'gosh coveralls with a sprig of...
Yeah, that was his Jimmy Carter uniform, yeah.
Yes, sprig of straw through the teeth, standing next to a very sleek-looking Italian sports car called the Ferraro, and Mr. Mondale facing the audience and saying, "Sure I'm going to pick up a lot of chicks with this little number."
Yeah, let me guess. All the girls with the wraparound tweed skirts and the ceramic earrings didn't like it. Is that correct?
95% of them. No, I tell you, a lot of them. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I saw the move as basically a the decision to have Geraldine Ferraro on the ticket was a political one, obviously, like all those decisions are. But that's exactly where he was coming from. He wanted to be the woman's candidate, and what a great way to do it.
The reaction I saw more commonly around here was for many people to go, "Oh, that's horrible."
Exactly. Well, see, that's that's what a cartoon does. I mean, the best cartoon you can do has that reaction. What a terrible thing to say, but isn't it right on the mark? I mean, that's really the role of the cartoonist, is to do something totally different and a little daring, maybe, that gets him in trouble, but that everybody kind of secretly agrees with. You know, they cut it out of the newspaper and show it around secretly, you know.
Have you tried to do anything on the prominence religion has taken in the campaign so far?
Yeah, I just did one on that. I took kind of a different tack, and I'm afraid it'll get me in a lot of trouble, but it was fun to do. Since everybody else is injecting religion into this thing, I injected religion, and I drew a picture of Christ carrying the cross up the hill, and there were a whole bunch of, you know, Jesse Jackson had his arm around him, was posing for a photo, and people were putting campaign buttons on Jesus, and they were putting bumper stickers on the cross, and Jesus is saying, "Gee, I was sort of hoping we could keep politics out of all this." But that hasn't run yet.
Jeff McNally, talking to NPR's Scott Simon. McNally passed away in 2000, but his comic strip, Shoe, still lives on. And all of this means one thing. It's time to stay right where you are and get some exercise. How's that possible? Susan Stamberg talks to Betty Switkus.
People can do it at a desk, can do it in their workplace. It's a great substitute for a coffee break, much better for your body, and even for your sense of well-being. You know, they're learning more and more with medical research that exercise improves your attitude, improves your emotional tone, as well as your muscle tone and your bones. Your bones get stronger.
All right, but let's put this to the test now, because you have a little cassette of music to which we do our exercises. We'll hear some of it, and you lead me through.
All right.
A chair-bound series of exercises.
First, put fingertips on your shoulders. Stretch one arm right up to the ceiling. Reach. Good. And bring those fingers back. Yes, it does. Other arm now. Reach. And back. Okay. Now, both arms reaching forward, parallel with the floor, and stretch and bring them back. One thing you have to learn is to move slowly in the beginning.
Okay, we'll let Betty and Susan continue their workout as we visit with the original atomic dog, George Clinton. He talked with NPR's Lynn Neary about crossing over to get his music and other black music on white-owned radio stations.
I would never go for crossover because most of the time it meant that I had to change from doing the music that I was doing to reach that crossover audience. Now, people, black or white, can enjoy, you know, same music, black, rock, or anything you want to call it.
Tell me about your own experience with the record companies at getting your music played. What kind of problems have you encountered?
I basically don't have too much problem. I mean, are we talking about black radio now?
No, getting played on non-black radio.
Oh, no, that's we probably have the hardest of that problem than anybody, because I specialize in real black music, so it'll probably be the last of the music of the black music to go on the non-black stations. We sold so many records. We could sell platinum to black people alone, and we do have quite a bit of white following, even though we're not on white radio. So first of all, you have to go number one on the black station, and then the pop station will consider putting it on. The record companies themselves would probably have to put more emphasis in what they believe in the black music before the stations would even think about it.
So what is it that your association what kind of changes is your association trying to bring about? What are you lobbying for right now?
The attention that this problem do exist, and let's look into it and see why do it exist and how can we change it? It exists, and it existed, and people accept it, so it almost like it's no problem, but it is a problem. They shouldn't have to go to number one before they cross over. I mean, that's ridiculous, especially now that you get a lot of pop records on R&B stations.
What about black music stations? Are they playing white music?
They are, because of the advertising dollars that white stations get. You get a lot of stations that play a lot of the music. That's not necessarily the music that the white music that the black kids or black people would even be interested in hearing. You can go too far in that and lose altogether the blackness of the station or the community station. I think that started happening for a minute.
So you don't necessarily want to see the end of stations which are clearly black-oriented music stations.
No way. Totally, but not having to go all the way out of their way and lose all of their identity just to get the advertisement dollars, you know, is not, you know, fair to the community either. But I definitely don't want to see it be, you know, segmented like all black. I mean, you know, because, I mean, that don't work for nobody. Just the same way I wouldn't want to see the white station do the same thing. You know, because it's about the collaboration and the mixture of the you know, human beings, period, that makes everything progress and move along.
I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback. And speaking of progress, how about that compact disc? Bob Edwards talked with Bert Gall, an engineer with Philips Electronics, about the superiority of this fresh-faced digital technology.
it doesn't scratch. That's one of the very large advantages. The whole system is much less vulnerable, say, to normal usage as a consumer is handling a disc normally at home.
It's not going to stick.
And it's not going to stick. It's so easy to operate. It's just a matter of a few buttons and the microcomputer inside the equipment is doing the rest, searching for track numbers, searching even for a particular time point on the disc. You can pre-program, say, a number, a particular sequence as you would like to have it to play, and that's all possible.
Compact disc players cost anywhere from $300 to over $1,000. The disc is about $15. When the disc was first introduced, only a handful of titles were available. But by the end of this year, some 2,000 titles are expected to be on the market. Many are classical, but you will also find the music of Michael Jackson, Bruce Springsteen, Billy Joel, and other popular artists. CD manufacturing companies and proponents such as Burt Gall expect this new technology to be the wave of the future. They hope that by the end of next year, people everywhere will be hearing the light. When do you think we'll reach the point where people won't even think to buy a phonograph record? They'll be buying a compact disc.
Yeah, well, we expect that this can be in a period of between 5 to 10 years from now. Okay, one of the limitations, say, from the consumer point of view, is that there is still a limited number of compact discs in the market available. But the more there is available, the more interesting it will be for the people to buy. And the price of discs and players will drop when the quantities are raising and more competition is coming into this area. And finally, everybody just would like to have one. Yes, yes, you had to be a big shot.
And if you're admiring the fine digital audio quality in the song, Big Shot, from Billy Joel's album, 52nd Street, you'd be absolutely on the money, because this was the very first full-length album released on CD. For more music and concerts and stuff you can download and stuff, visit npr.org/music. I did come across a little bit of serendipity buried in a story about a DC comedy competition. Here's an interview with comedian Ellen DeGeneres a year after winning that competition.
I was working in a law firm when the contest came along, and I decided to go for it. And I ended up winning the New Orleans thing, and it kept going on and on and on.
And so has it changed your life?
Yeah, it has. It's been, I've had a nose job. And gotten calls from David Letterman's show, from The Tonight Show. I'm up for a couple of major movies and a couple of national commercials, and I have a lot more friends.
Getting up in front of a crowd is the easy part for Ellen DeGeneres. It's the writing of comedy that's tough.
I have real high standards, and I don't like to do anything that's close to what... I try to come up with a subject like a hammock and say, no one's done anything about hammocks. What could be funny about that? I come up with things that nobody's talking about, because that's what's going to set you apart. You're going to do material about... contraceptives and about Michael Jackson and about, you know, Reagan and things like that, they're done, you know, it's going to happen.
So who's your audience in the back of your mind? Who are you writing to?
I'm writing to me, and hopefully I think that I'm definitely going to have a certain type of audience that is I'm going to appeal to, because I am really off the wall as far as, you know, most of my stuff, and I'm developing that kind of audience already in San Francisco. That's a good place for me. But you tend to get spoiled because you have a good audience that really likes your off-the-wall stuff, and then you go to Oklahoma City. Is this going to Oklahoma City?
Yes.
They're looking at you like you're a brilliant person, and they're the nicest people I've ever dealt with in my life.
Ellen DeGeneres, developing her own brand of comedy, pre-American Idol, pre-Ellen the Talk Show, and before her starring role, Finding Nemo.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome to our show. Don't
George Carlin would have had a hard time playing Oklahoma City or any other number of places in the 70s and early 80s because many parts of his routine dealt with drugs, bodily functions, and the seven words you can't say on television.
Because of the FCC, I'm never sure of what it is I'm allowed to say. So I now have my own official policy. This is the language you will not be hearing tonight. All right. You will not hear me say bottom line, game plan, role model, scenario, or hopefully.
In the fall of 84, he started off on a tour that took him from Chicago to San Diego and to the Desert Inn in Las Vegas. He talked to NPR's Scott Simon.
I quit those hotels in 1970. Actually, I was fired, and I was in the midst of feeling out of place anyway, so it was sort of mutual. And then when I became hot, of course, their morality is based on business. So when I wasn't very well known, my language offended them. But when I got well known for bad language, they didn't mind that. So I do go to those hotels occasionally.
Do you think you push your material a little bit farther than some other comics?
Well, I take some liberties. Mm-hmm. With my audience. And I use the personal pronoun there because one can think of the audience as his own if they've come to see you, if you're the attraction. So the people that come to see me are generally in my corner already, and they know what they're in for, as it were. They know the kinds of things I do. So I can step over the line more often without risking too much with them.
Philadelphia man was arrested today while attempting to make an unauthorized deposit in a sperm bank. Silent film star Mark Dunbar died today in Hollywood. He had no last words. However, he did make several gestures.
So I do like to have a little adventure in some of the subject matter.
You have a book that's come out now. George Carlin, Sometimes a Little Brain Damage Can Help.
Right, which is a collection of things that didn't fit the stand-up mode. I think there are a lot of things that are funny, that are much funnier when you read them, because you can go back over them, you can dwell on them, let them sink in a little more. Whereas in a show, in a theater, of course, the words are gone immediately and you're on to the next thought.
Well, I want to ask you about a section in the middle of this book. There is a picture of you being arrested in Milwaukee in 1972.
Yes.
And your rap sheet from that arrest in 1972 is superimposed over it. Firstly, I cannot begin to say what you're accused of saying here, but I mean, did they get it right pretty much in that police report?
They got it right, except they got the order wrong. I put it in a nice order where it had some euphonious quality, you know, that it sounded good to say them in that order. They completely mixed up the order of the words, but of course, then again, they weren't going for laughs, they were going for law.
I think Lenny Bruce used to complain that the policemen that reinterpreted or gave their own renditions of his acts always got it wrong so that it never seemed funny.
Yeah, he said I was going to jail for this guy doing my act wrong.
Am I wrong? You seem a little bit proud of that.
Well, sure. I'm proud of it because one of those kids who was always in trouble in school for making people laugh or for doing something out of order, disrupting the class, preventing someone else from getting their education. And so to me, the feeling of being arrested for a spoken word violation, and especially with all those policemen, you notice there are five policemen handling me, and all I did was say something wrong. Can you imagine how many policemen they would have had if I had had a gun and had started you know, firing at people? But I sort of enjoyed in a perverse way getting in trouble for that because I knew in my heart it wasn't immoral and it was barely even illegal. In fact, it wasn't illegal.
Uh-huh. All right, let me ask you about something. Do you need a certain amount of irritation for your comedy?
What I've found, I can be aggressive without being hostile on stage. And when I want to summon up a feeling that's similar to anger, I find I can give that feeling and not be actually angry in my gut. And I used to, on stage, I used to experience the anger in my gut, and I would, my blood pressure would get very high, and I was truly experiencing the emotion then, and sometimes it overloaded, it was bad for the comedy. Now I find that when I want to show that, there's enough of an echo of that emotion in my mind that I can simulate it, and I can get the effect I want, as an actor would, I guess, and I don't pay any cost for it, and I don't upset the balance of the comedy this way.
George Carlin died in June 2008. And now, it's time for that small mammal story we've heard so much about. Here it is, the second installment of First File, an occasional series where we ask various NPR personalities about their broadcast debut. This is a story we call Rat Olympics, for lack of a better title. It originally aired in May 1978.
The undisputed host of the second annual Rat Olympics is Winooski, Vermont, where the students of St. Michael's College turn from the pursuit of higher education to join the rat race. For commentary in color from the Olympic Village locker room, here's Art Silverman of Vermont Public Radio.
How's the training going? Is he following the course pretty well?
Yeah, he follows the course well. He has a little trouble coming from the 4-foot dash up the ladder. And he's doing well. He has last year's record beaten by a couple of seconds, which is good. But there's a lot of fast rats this year.
Come on. Go, go, go. Here, take your rat. Come on. Oh, you're not even doing it. Come on.
You allowed to blow on the rat?
Yeah, you can't touch the rat, but you can blow. He likes to be blown on his back end. That gets him going.
It's a proud moment for a rat selected to the Olympics. It is not only the exhilaration of being in a room full of small rodents set to do battle, but the tingling expectation of the reward, usually a rat pellet or a bit of peanut butter. Events like the rope climb or the 4-foot dash push the rats to their outer limits, each rat striving for a new record.
4 feet up.
Ready? Get set. Go!
Rat's halfway up the ladder now. Seems to be moving at constant speed. 3/4 of the way up, stops. Has a look around, looking up and down. Now reaches near the top, stopping near the third to the top rung, and sniffing. Dr. Barry Crickstone is the father of modern-day Rat Olympics. As a proponent of the sport, Crickstone must deal with people who don't understand the need for Rat Olympics.
I think the average person who may come to watch the event may be more interested in the competition and novelty of it than in the educational purpose of it.
We're going to start this evening with a special mascot, albino rat, which has been named Alice Bino, who is going to run this Olympic marathon decathlon course, which is 10 events. She will start on a floor, climb up a rope, do a little run, climb up a ladder, run a 4-foot dash, crisscross some beer cans, climb 2 hurdles, go through 3 tunnels, climb up a ladder, and as the grand finale, she will raise the Olympic flag. She's climbing up the rope, halfway up the rope. She's pulling. Oh, she's made it to the top. She's approaching the ladder, climbing up the ladder, in the box, down the 4-foot run, 1 foot, 2 foot, speeding up, down the end of the run, into the beer cross run, crisscross the cans, over the hurdles, approaching the hurdles, first sniffing around, seeing who's been there before. Hurdle one, quickly approaching and over hurdle two, around the bend and down tunnel, whoops, one, coming to tunnel three, up the ladder, to the flag, and here she goes, a feat unparalleled in animal history. And here it comes.
Now, I know you're wondering, who came up with this story? What's going on? What's with the sophisticated production techniques? And in a word, we'll tell you. Art Silverman. He's a 30-plus year NPR veteran with a flair for the original. NPR's Joelle Estrelli recently asked Art about his first file.
Somehow we got hooked on animals are cute early on. Somehow that's a terrific story. And we needed something that was basically expendable. And let's see, if I remember, anything with hammered dulcimers, clown college, cute animals, little things of American life that would cost basically nothing to do, that weren't fit for the regular part of the program, that were, as I recall the time, 3 minutes and 56 seconds long. And if a station had to do something important like a traffic report or school lunch menu, then you could cover it over with your local content and come back to the show when the real stuff came on.
When you listened to that story, did you think it was funny?
Just now, I I thought the potential was funny. I liked my voice. The part that made me think this is funny is where I was doing the kind of play-by-play. I didn't think the content was particularly funny, but I thought, okay, I was trying something that, you know, aimed toward a certain type of humor, and that was good. But what I really thought was this piece could be improved. This piece could be so much better with a little bit of editing and some rewriting and different tape and maybe another guy voicing it.
So it's likely that only 5 stations carried the Rat Olympic story or something like that?
If that.
Yeah.
But when I went to do it, I said, this is safe. This doesn't involve matters of life and death. I know I'm new at this. I'm not very good at it. If I screw this up, I'm not going to embarrass anyone except for these rats and myself. And there was no controversy in it. There were no real facts. That was important to me. I've learned that there are better ways to tell a story than just having a talking head. And I'm just always looking for that. I don't really like the critter stories. I don't like dogs that much. Cats I could barely tolerate. Monkeys are always funny, and I'd go for a monkey story every time. But I prefer to do stories that people don't expect to be funny. When they're given to you, when you have a funny monkey or a funny dog, it's too easy. Anyone could do it. I mean, you get people chuckling before you start. It's when you come on with, like, healthcare and then it takes people somewhere else that you didn't expect. That's a realm that I like to explore.
That was NPR producer Art Silverman, interviewed by NPR's very own Joella Straley. We hope you've enjoyed your playback experience. Special help for this podcast came from Miss Straley, Michael Katziff, and the man, the myth, Mr. Robert Speer. On our next playback, we hear Barbara Bush describe vice presidential candidate Geraldine Ferraro with a word that rhymes with witch. And it has nothing to do with Halloween. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.
Now sit up again.
Yeah.
And again, go down and stretch.
Wait, but the chair keeps moving away from under me.